Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, wonderful. So good evening, everyone. Welcome to our next session in the 50 Greatest Ideas of the Bible. We are the Bible's top 50 ideas using the book by Dov Peretz Elkins, Rabbi Elkins from Princeton, now of Israel, made Aliyah, and it's put together this wonderful book that we're using. We're going to be looking at chapter 11 has the verse, indeed, all the earth is mine, but you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the children of Israel. So we're going to talk about this idea of being a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. But before we go into that, I just want to make a couple of public service announcements now so that we don't forget them. We've got on this coming Sunday evening at B'nai Tikva, we've got the movie The Gatekeepers, an interview with six former heads of the Shin Bet who are talking about the reality of Israeli society, the struggle with the terrorists, and the internal political struggle in Israel, the struggle with Jewish terrorists, and all kinds of intriguing matters of policy and diplomacy and so forth. It's a stunning film. It was nominated for an Academy Award. It's that, and it really deserves it. Frankly, it deserved to win it. It's an incredibly revealing film. We should definitely be here for that. That's Sunday evening at 7 o'clock. Minyan will be at 6:45, so that way we finish Minyan before we actually go into the film. And Martin Raffel, who was the executive vice president of the JCPA and probably knows more people in the Jewish world than anybody except Malcolm Honlein, is going to be here to sort of be a little bit in dialogue with me, and then we'll take questions together. So that's going to be a lot of fun. And then on January 28th, we've got Mordechai Kedar. Mordechai Kedar is one of the world's great experts in Arab literature. He has probably advised every Israeli government for the past 30 years on the Israeli-Palestinian citizens, the Israeli Arabs. He is going to be speaking about the academic boycott of Israel, which is an increasingly looming threat. Then right at the end of the month, on January 31st, we're having our next session of CBT Goes to the Movies, and we're going to be showing a film, a provocative film, shall we say, entitled When Do We Eat?, which is a sarcastic takeoff on a madcap takeoff on the Pesach Seder. This is very definitely for adults only. I'm not bringing the kids to this one. When you see the movie, you'll understand why. But it should be fun. Okay, so we'll go back to our topic now. And what we're going to talk about is this concept of the chosen people, which is an amazingly misunderstood concept, misunderstood both by Jews and by non-Jews. And before we continue with the Rabbi Elkins text, I'd like you to take out the Siddur and go to page 98 in the Siddur. Page 98 at the bottom of the page. Now this is the bracha. It's the bracha that immediately precedes the Shema in the morning. It's called Ahava Rabba Avtanu. With great love you have loved us, Lord our God. The last line, which is mistranslated here, or lyrically translated, otherwise known as mistranslated, it says, Baruch Ata Hashem, HaBocher Be'amo Yisrael Be'ahava. Blessed are you, God, who chooses his people Israel with love. Okay, that's mistranslated as praise to you, Lord, who loves his people Israel. But it's more than just that he loves his people Israel. Yeah, we get that. But they're trying to dodge the bullet here because they're embarrassed by the concept, all right, when in fact what really is happening is that God has chosen the Jewish people and did that act of choosing the Jewish people, did so with love. Okay, Gary, was that a question or no? Okay. So that's how this prayer ends. So working backwards, if that's how the prayer ends, then obviously the beginning of the prayer tells us something about what this choosing is all about. That's why the prayer ends with, you know, blessed are you who chose us, you know, who chose us with love. So what exactly did God choose us for? So now go back to the top of the prayer, which is in the middle of the page. Deep is your love for us, Lord our God, boundless your tender compassion. You taught our ancestors life-giving laws. They trusted in you, our Father and King. For their sake, graciously teach us. Father, merciful Father, show us mercy. Grant us discernment and understanding. Then will we study your Torah, heed its words, teach its precepts, follow its instruction, lovingly fulfill all its teachings. Open our eyes to your Torah. Help our hearts cleave to your mitzvot. Unite all our thoughts to love and revere you. Then shall we never be brought to shame. Trusting in your awesome holiness, we will delight in your deliverance. Bring us safely from the ends of the earth and lead us in dignity to our holy land. You are the source of deliverance. You have called us from all peoples and tongues, constantly drawing us nearer to you that we may lovingly offer you praise, proclaiming your oneness. Praised are you, Lord, who has chosen us, or chosen your people Israel, with love. Okay, so chosenness, as interpreted here, is intimately linked to what? Torah, mitzvot, tefillah, prayer, and praise. Okay, doesn't say anything about conquering the world. Doesn't say anything about being richer than everybody else. Doesn't compare us to anybody except in this aspect of being chosen. Doesn't say we're smarter than everybody else. Doesn't say we're better than everybody else. It says God chose to give us the Torah. Okay. Now, there ought to be some consequences of that. You know, the fact that God has given us the Torah, that should, in fact, impact on who we are. Right. But it's not that God chose us because we are somehow so wonderful and special. We became unique because God chose us for Torah. It's real important that, like, get the perspective right. You know, there's not something ontologically different about Jews, something, you know, in the nature of our being that made us different, and because of that, God gave us the Torah. All right, or God chose us, you know, because we were different. We became different because God chose us. Okay, so with that introduction in mind, I want to go back to the Elkins book and work our way through his chapter on this. Chapter 11 is page 69 in the book. So this verse that we just read about being a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, right, that verse, it comes from the chapter that immediately precedes the Ten Commandments. So it's the sort of the dramatic build-up to this incredible moment when the revelation takes place. And so this idea of being being special, of being chosen, is intimately linked to something covenantal. All right, that is to say, this unique contractual relationship that we have with God that governs our behavior toward God, and also, in its own way, commits God to certain behavior toward us. It's a two-way street. You know, we're supposed to do this. God's supposed to do that. All right? We're supposed to follow the commandments. God's going to, protect us, bring us back to the land, and so forth. And one physical manifestation of that is that when you are reciting the prayer, the Abba Rabba prayer in the morning before the Shema, okay, when you get to the line about V'havienu l'shalom yabakan fata aretz, bring us in peace from the four corners of the earth. When you say the four corners of the earth, that's when you take your four tzitzit. Okay, and that's when you put them in the hand. So God's taking us from the four corners. We're taking our four corners. Okay, we're going to do our part. The four corners, the symbolic of the mitzvot. So we're going to do our mitzvot. That's our part of the deal. Now we expect God to do his part of the deal, which is to bring us from the four corners of the earth. Okay? And after this prayer, then you read all the way through the Shema, and then at the end of the Shema, and you start getting into the blessing after the Shema, which is the blessing about redemption, when you get to the part that says, God's faithfulness endures for all time, his teachings are precious and abiding, they live forever, that's when you kiss the tzitzit for the last time and drop them. Okay? So, you know, we're going to do our part. You're faithful for all time. You do your part. All right, it's part of the bargain there. And the reason it is so crucial, the reason I really want to sort of hammer that home, is that there is this sort of infection that we find in Jewish life that really attempts to define a Jewish life in the absence of God, or the absence of the spiritual connection to the mitzvot. Okay, there are those who really see in sort of like the sociology of the Jewish people, who see, you know, a certain kind of like transcendent value in that, who see simply the nationalism of the Jewish people as being sort of an end unto itself. And as much as I'm a Jewish nationalist, as you all know, right, that seeing that Jewish naturalism bereft of any divine or spiritual component is really a profound distortion of our tradition. And we have to recognize how profound it is, a profound distortion it is. So to put it one really concrete example, because we've been reading about it the past couple of Shabbatot, when it says, and God said, let my people go. What's the next word? Vayavduni, so that they will serve me. All right. It's not simply about the political liberation of the Jewish people. Not that that's a bad thing. But to leave out that last word, to quote the Bible, to quote God declaring, let my people go so that they will serve me, and to leave off that last word is an incredible distortion. It's really doing violence to the text. It's almost to the point of almost abusive of the text. Right? Yes, of course we want Jews to be let go. You know, Jews out of the Soviet Union, if not blessed memory. You know, Jews, you know, caught in Yemen or wherever they, you know, Ethiopia or wherever. Yeah, we want them out, sure, yeah. But we must never lose sight of what we're here for. Why we're here at all. Why we are a people at all. We're a people with a mission. You know, the Blues Brothers, we're on a mission from God. You know, we are. Right? And I really want that tie, actually. There is a Blues Brothers tie. It costs like $50. I'm not spending $50 for a tie, but I really want that tie. You know, we're on a mission from God. And, you know, there are many manifestations of our Jewish peoplehood that are very attractive in their own right. But when you pull back from it and look at the overall picture, if you take God out of that picture, it simply cannot stand. We will not last very long. It's just not who we are supposed to be. So, looking now at the second paragraph on page 70, in order to carry out God's sacred mission, the Israelite people must attain national independence. Without the authority to live the lifestyle and value system which are commanded by God in the covenant, and which are uniquely that of the Israelite nation, they would be too much subject to the forces of surrounding nations to carry out their God-given task. This is an incredibly crucial thing, because lachatz hagalut aleinu, the pressure of living in exile, is upon us. We have been distorted to believe that, say, people living in Muncie or Lakewood, you know, they're really religious. They're the really religious people. You know, people living in Bnei Brak or Meir Shearim, they're the really religious people. And that's absolutely nonsense. That's absolutely nonsense. Not because they don't have whatever spirituality they have. You will find among them good and spiritual people. But what's perfectly clear, looking at the Torah and the Tanakh, what is absolutely crystal clear is that the mandate of the Bible is for the Jewish people to be living independently in its own nation, in the land of Israel, creating a society that follows certain kinds of spiritual and moral parameters. And there are so to speak two different ways to betray that. All right. One is to really say yes, Jews should be living in Israel, but forget about this whole religious, spiritual, moral baggage that we carry with us. Right. Or the other is to say, oh, I don't need anything to live in Israel. I don't need to live in an independent society. I could have my own little parasitic society over here and just like sort of live like the Amish. Right? Both of those are an equal betrayal of what Judaism is meant to be, what our chosenness is supposed to be all about, of being that nation of Kohanim. Okay, and that's what we're going to turn to now. All right, and what does it mean to be a nation, a kingdom of priests? Mamlechet Kohanim, right? Mamlecha is a government and nation, and Kohanim is like Kohen Levi Israel. You call it the Kohen first, all right? So, the analogy that's being made is that what the Kohen is to the Jewish people is supposed to be to the nations of the world. Okay. Now, back in the day, right? I mean, right now, because of the the temple system has been destroyed and so forth, the Kohen in our society has only a marginal sort of echo of years past role in our society. You know, he has the first Aliyah, right? And in very traditional services, the Kohen will be called on to Duchen to give a special blessing to the congregation. But before the rabbis came into the world, so we're talking about 2,000 years ago when the temple was still standing, the Kohanim had an entirely different function. All right, they were the teachers. They were the ones that provided sort of ritual purity to the community. All right, and one could see them as ministers. That is to say, they minister to the community. The role of the Israelites as Kohanim is not meant in the ritual sense, but in the spiritual sense, as moral leaders. And I can't emphasize this point enough, that we Jews are meant to be moral leaders. And it is particularly grating. I mean, it's certainly grating when you have this sort of betrayal of our Jewish values than when you have rabbis stealing money or taking pictures of women in the mikveh or all these truly disgusting, horrible things. There is actually even a foot, you might have seen this, there is this moral declaration signed by I don't know, thousands of rabbis and Jewish teachers that basically say, we are so disgusted by the stuff that we hear, rabbis going to the sauna with their students and, all the stuff that, it's sort of a moral declaration of, our responsibility as Jewish teachers to be above all this garbage, right? So we all know about that level of betrayal. But there's a deeper level of betrayal as well. And that is the betrayal of Jews, even Jews known as or commonly referred to as religious Jews, who are betraying their responsibility as members of the chosen people to be the moral exemplars to the world. It's very politically incorrect to talk about that. Who are you to consider yourself a moral exemplar? Who am I? I'm one of the guys that God chose to be a moral exemplar. That's what when you're a card-carrying Jew, that's what it means. So what that means is not just that the rabbis who do horrible things are a disgrace. They are, right? But even the run-of-the-mill Jew who does not see himself or herself as having any kind of special role, any kind of special responsibility for uniquely advanced moral behavior is betraying who we are. And that's just as true of, the quote, religious communities that are, doing, social security fraud, or money laundering or all the other garbage that goes on, all right, and Medicare fraud and everything else. This is a profound betrayal of who we are supposed to be. he points out that often in English, Mamlechet Kohanim is translated as a priestly kingdom. That is to say, a kingdom that resembles a sort of the priestly caste, the covenant mediator. All right. Our job is to be, on the one hand, God's conduit to the people, on the other, the people's conduit to God. Okay, Jade, was that a question that you had?
Somewhat. When you talk about the moral responsibility of the Jew, doesn't all people have that kind of a responsibility? I mean, money laundering or anything like this or anything else is wrong, and it's not only a question of Jews, it's a question of humanity.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the short answer is, well, yes, of course, everybody has that responsibility. Okay, but here the question is, what role do expectations play? Right. There was an interesting debate that took place a couple of years ago when, rabbis gone wild, some rabbi, stole money or did whatever, and it might have been in the Syrian community when the leader of the community was arrested for money laundering and was on front page of the newspapers. And so there was a big debate, and a lot of people wrote in sort of objecting to the fact that everybody was making a big deal about this fact that, that since he was Jewish, he was a rabbi, and so it was almost like anti-Semitic. Why are you picturing this when, it's just as bad when everybody else does it, blah, blah, blah. Okay. And somebody else pointed out that if you look carefully at Maimonides, who writes about this, he says very specifically that because we are Jews, we are supposed to be held to a higher standard. And because somebody is who is a rabbi and theoretically is learned, they're to be held to an even higher standard. So although, yes, it is absolutely morally incumbent on everybody to, follow the rules, not do the money laundering, not to steal, not to sleep around, everybody shares those. But because of who we are, because of the texts that we have had access to for thousands of years now, right, we are supposed to be, the people are supposed to have higher expectations. It is actually an insult for people not to have higher expectations of us. And of us, people who are really steeped in the tradition, right, that it is reasonable, it is more than reasonable, it's almost mandatory to have even higher expectations of them. We are meant to be kept to a higher standard. The problem that which arises, and which is very problematic, right, and this is particularly true about Israel, although it's always been true in terms of anti-Semitism, is when we keep a higher standard and then the outside society lies about it. Okay. That's where the problem really comes in. It's one thing to say, you Jews, you should be on a higher standard. I don't want to be compared to, I don't want Israel to be compared to Syria. That's an insult. All right. We're supposed to be light years ahead. We are. But when people then make up lies in order to still attack us, even though we are light years ahead, then there's a problem. Okay, Rachel, you had a comment?
Since we don't have a temple anymore and we're not doing sacrifices, so now it's considered sort of the role of a rabbi is looked on as a Kohen or a Kohen Gadol,
mm-hmm.
because you're the one that everybody comes to ask questions about religious things there. I mean, those
right.
are the guys you went to say,
yes.
I did wrong, how many whatever do I have to sacrifice?
Right.
How then can you say, how then do you look at it in the role of a rabbi leading the flock, so to speak?
Mm-hmm.
And when you see these rabbis doing bad things,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How can put yourself in the role. How can you justify even something like that? I mean, the Catholic Church just had all the stuff with the priests and
sure.
and being pedophiles there also, and these are the people who are supposed to be leading the flock. How do you disassociate yourself from being, you know, not thinking I'm up there and, yes, I'm a normal person in the planet?
I got to tell you, this is a really, really big deal. The damage that is done to us by that breakdown in trust, by that necessary breakdown in trust, it's catastrophic. It is absolutely catastrophic. The idea, the perversion of authority, sacred authority is supposed to have a certain value. You know, and I'll tell you what I mean by that. If I meet some guy on the street, and we're going to have a debate about, you know, politics, Trump, immigration law, you know, whatever, all right, so I'll say what I'll say, he'll say what he says, and we're debating on this level of ideas, and it's, you know, okay, fine. Right, or it could be debating on the level of emotions. But that's not supposed to be what the relationship between a rabbi and a congregant is. All right. There is supposed to be an awareness that the rabbi is meant to be a conduit of that which is holy, a conduit, a connection to the 4,000 years worth of books, and the wisdom of the ages. The rabbi is supposed to be that sort of walking anthology. And not only just in terms of information, but also in terms of wisdom. And that's why people will come to me, you know, and they do it now, but they did it when I was 28. You know, they will come to me assuming that I will have something of value or interest to say about virtually any situation. You know, not because, you know, I'm so wonderful. It's because I'm the one that's been in touch with the holy books. Right? That requires an enormous amount of trust. And if people really have the feeling that I was, for whatever purpose, whether economic or sexual or whatever, that I was sort of like manipulating the system for my own benefit, all of that goes right down the tubes. And not just in terms of my relationship to other congregants, or to congregants, but in the relationship between those congregants and any other rabbi anywhere, it's disastrous and just cosmically shameful. So I really have nothing but contempt for those of my colleagues who pull stunts like this. Right? It's really disgraceful. Nevertheless, this is the exception that gives proof to the rule. We are so upset about it precisely because it is a betrayal of who we are supposed to be. Okay. So, so if you look at the next to last paragraph on page 70, Nachmanides gives more color to the metaphor of comparing us to Kohanim when he explains that the Kohen symbol here means a people living a holy life devoted to the service of God. Rabbi Ovadia Sforno, one of the great biblical commentators, suggests that Israel be an inspiration and model people to all humanity. All right. Now, there were Jewish movements that really picked up on that theme. So classic reform very much picked up on this theme. Where in our traditional prayer book, when it says, "Mipnei chataeinu galinu mi'artzeinu," because of our sins we were exiled from our land. Okay. in the classic Reform prayer book, the prayer continues, and our prayer continues, and because of that, we can't come to Jerusalem to do the sacrifices the way we're supposed to, blah, blah, blah. In the classical Reform prayer book, all right, because of our sins, we were exiled from our land in order to be a light unto the nations. And in order to bring our, you know, wisdom, Torah, whatever, morals to the nations. And so they really emphasize this idea of becoming moral exemplars, which is sort of the theological, ideological background to why it is that they were so freaked out when Jews started coming to America from Eastern Europe. Because we, because I'm part of that, you know, were considered to be, you know, so backward and so unevolved that we were sort of a betrayal to that mission, that ethical mission. And it's one of the reasons why it was wealthy people within the Reform movement that paid to start the conservative movement, to train rabbis who were traditional enough that they could talk to the guys getting off the boat, but still Americanized enough to move them in the right direction. Okay. Oh, yeah, that's where we came from. It was our crowd, the German Reform Jews. Okay. He's the second generation. He comes in later. He's in the 20s. This is happening back at the turn of the century. All right. So the seminary is established to Americanize the American Jewish community, which it did remarkably. The reason the conservative movement is sort of floundering a little bit right now is because we haven't redefined our mission. You know, now that we have accomplished this, okay, I mean, there are none of our children, let me get the grammar straight on this one, none of our children feel in any way un-American. They are totally integrated into American society. All right. There's no debate about, gee, am I American Jew or Jewish American? This is just like not on anybody's radar screen at all. They're as American as apple pie. And have been for 25 years. So now that we have arrived and, you know, mission accomplished, well, now what do we do? And the conservative movement has barely begun to figure that out. All right. So that's, you know, where we are founding here. All right. But we are intended to be that model. The traditional Israeli commentary, Dat Mikra, details what the task of a Kohen is and thus how this should apply to Israel. And take a step back for a second. Forget all about everything you know about sort of the venality of daily Jewish life. You know, the Lashon Hora, the backbiting, the, you know, board members playing, you know, kicking sand in each other's face in the sandbox, you know, all of the stupidity, all of the crassness, you know, Long Island, you know, I mean, just forget about all of that, okay? And just think about this as what would we look like if we looked like this? I want you to think that. All right. Details what the task of the Kohen is and thus how this should apply to Israel. The Kohen is closer to God than the rest of the people. So is Israel closer to God than other nations. The Kohen accepts more obligations than other members of the people. So too do the Jewish people accept upon themselves more religious responsibilities than other nations. Kashrut, Shabbat, Brit Milah, and so forth. The Kohen atones for the people. So Israel atones for the nations through its exemplary behavior. The Kohen teaches the people respect for God. So the Jewish people is to teach the nations of the world respect for God and God's ethical laws. Okay. It is a big deal. All right. Jay, you seem incredibly pained by this.
It sets us up as being beyond human. Expectations or otherwise, Jews are still people. And while we may strive, but while we may have the goals, I don't see us as being above anyone. I can see another group being good, being excellent, and within the group, we have bad, they have bad, we have better, and so on. And yet, from what you're saying, it seems to us, to me, that you are putting us as a group way above, and I just don't see it.
Okay. So, first, let me say that when you say that I am putting us way above, I am certainly putting us way above in terms of expectation. All right. I am only slightly putting us above in terms of execution. Okay. As far as the first part is concerned, we are very definitely intended to be above. Above in the sense of being moral exemplars, of being teachers, of establishing a moral society, and so forth. There is no question about the fact that that's what our tradition is mandating of us. There really is, he mentions this, but I'll hop ahead a little bit. There is the classic midrash about why did we get the Ten Commandments, where God goes to all of the different nations of the world and offers them the Ten Commandments. And they say, well, what's in it? And God says, well, thou shalt not steal. So one nation says, are you kidding me? We make our living by stealing. We can't accept that. And then he goes to another nation and says, and they say, what's in it? And he says, oh, well, you shall not commit adultery. And they say, are you kidding me? It's like standard operating procedure for we all commit adultery. And he goes from nation to nation. Each one says no because they can't do. The Jews turn around and say, well, how many mitzvot are there? He says, 613. Na seven ishma. We'll do it and we'll understand it. So there is an assumption that, yeah, we have accepted upon, our self-perception was that we were prepared to accept as moral, as obligatory upon us, this array of things that other people were not willing to accept. Wait one second. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, I think it's really important to mention that one of the classic explanations for the source of anti-Semitism, and one that absolutely played a major role in terms of Nazism, was the link between Sinai and Sinah. Sinai is Sinai, Mount Sinai, where we get the Torah. Sinah is hatred. That the hatred is because of Sinai. The hatred is because of the weight of moral obligation and moral responsibility and standards that we have brought into the world. Because we have brought these things into the world, that this has, sort of forced people into taking moral responsibilities. It's one of the reasons that the Nazis really either, took great glee in burning every Torah that they didn't want to put into a museum, of really desecrating the Torah scroll. It was a really big deal for them to desecrate the Torah scrolls because they really saw Jewish morality as being the major threat against their ideology. Right? So, in terms of what the expectations on us, there's no question about the fact that, yes, we are supposed to be higher simply by virtue of, two things. One is the contact that we have had. We've had 4,000 years to deal with this. All right, so there's a kind of collective experience that's passed on. But also, because of having the kind of reinforcing society where, theoretically, we're supposed to be getting ourselves to do all this stuff, to maintain that moral standard. So, in other words, can you have moral individuals, either, let's say, non-Jewish moral individuals in places that are just as moral as we are? Absolutely, no question about it. But if, in terms of a society working together as a whole, where this is meant to be what we do, you'd be hard-pressed to find a society that does this the way we do. I'll give you just one cute example of that. I remember I was taking a taxi ride in Israel. This is when I was studying back in 1977. A couple of us from the seminary, got into this taxi. And the taxi driver says, I was thinking about the seventh chapter in Maimonides' eight chapters on ethics, and I had this question, and that's when he started and asking us this question. Can you imagine a taxi driver in New York doing something like that? All right, but here it was like a sort of this normal thing that the taxi driver would be asking us this question about a classic religious ethical text. That's what the taxi drivers talk about. It's a natural, normal thing. If you look on Israeli television, standard Israeli television, you will see these people who are doing sort of these heavy-duty philosophical, theological commentaries. All right, and sort of not exactly sermons, but you know, discussions that have that are politically apposite, you know, that apply to what's going on in the world, but using classical sources, really incredibly erudite stuff, top of the line stuff. Okay, it ain't SpongeBob SquarePants. Okay, it's the real deal. This is supposed to be like the natural stuff that you have going on in a society. And in this sense, Israeli society is a unique kind of a place. When you think even on the most secular of kibbutzim, the intensity of the study that takes place, you know, and the struggle to find the right thing. Now, even though the right thing, if you're at Shomayat Zeir Kibbutz, the right thing is going to be like Trotskyite or something, but nevertheless, it's going to be like chapter and verse and trying to nail down the right thing. There is a fervor for doing it right that really is a remarkable characteristic of the Jewish community. And I would go a step further. I mentioned this, Gary, forgive me for repeating myself, but I mentioned this at lunch today as well. If you want a real treat, go Google Colonel Jeffrey Kemp, K-E-M-P. And he was the commander of British forces in Afghanistan. And when the Gaza War happened, and people were accusing Israel of like this blatant disregard for civilian life, blah, 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 all right, he went nuts. And he you can see this online, where he says, and I'm virtually quoting, that there never in history has there been an army that has shown as much sensitivity towards civilian life as the Israeli army. Right? That didn't come from nowhere. That came from an incredibly rigorous application of moral values that really are, forgive me for saying so, superior to, light years ahead of, what you will find in any other army, in any other society on the planet. And I'll include England and France and so forth, you know, and the United States. All right. So, yeah, there is this level of morality that really is there, and it really is unique, and it really is superior. All right. Now, again, it's not because we Jews are ontologically different. It's that we've got this society that's reinforcing this stuff. All right. And if we can point to, in our own society, people who do not come anywhere close to living that high moral level, you know, and we certainly can find people like that quite readily, okay, that just goes to underscore how much we are betraying our tradition. Because we should be doubly ashamed of ourselves. We should be ashamed of ourselves simply because we're violating a moral standard like any other human being. And also, we are violating our Jewish mission to be this special nation of priests. Okay? Jay, was that a comment coming? Wait one second.
Yes.
Okay.
There's no question about being the conscience of the world and its effect in Europe and that. But the other thing I wanted to go back to is the acceptance of Torah, etc., at Mount Sinai. There's also the story about the reason we accept it is God held it, the world over us.
Right. And God made us do it. Right. Yes. The story is it's a lovely reference that the way that you say standing at the foot of a mountain, that idiomatic expression, standing at the foot of a mountain, is tachtit hahar. It simply means the foot of the mountain. But it literally comes from the word tachat, meaning under. All right. So tachtit hahar is under the mountain. And the rabbis used that reference when they were talking about Mount Sinai, that they were that we were standing tachti tahar, that God had picked Mount Sinai up and held it over our heads and said, you're going to accept the Torah or not? Okay. So yes, no question, Jay, that there is something coercive about this. All right. There was something coercive about it collectively, and there's something coercive about it on the personal level. Yeah, it's demanding of us that we act in a way that we might not feel like acting. No, no question about it. Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I say so unashamedly. But that goes to underscore why it is that Judaism in its traditional form is so problematic in the modern age. Because the modern age is entirely voluntaristic. Right? Nobody does anything because they're supposed to. They do things because they want to. Right? I mean, there was a time when you used the words, you know, obligation, duty, you know, if you use those words to a modern group of people, they almost won't know what you're talking about. I'll give you a reference. Right? My father, may he rest in peace, he told me the story that on Monday morning after December 7th, all right, he walked out the door and marched down to the armory to enlist. And as he marched, you know, when he left, all right, you could look up the block. At every single house, a guy was walking out the door, and they were all, you know, marching down to, you know, down to the armory. All right, the nation had been attacked. Nobody, it wasn't a question. It wasn't, well, gee, what should I do? Or, well, gee, I don't really want to. I mean, I was planning on going to college or blah, blah. No, this is what you did. All right? You just got out. You started marching down to the armory and, you know, out of every door. It was like a cowboy movie. You know, out of every door, it was another guy that was coming until you had 1,000 people standing in front of the armory waiting to enlist. All right? You know, my luck, my father couldn't do it because he had flat feet and my eyes. All right, so, but he tried to enlist 4 times, including cheating on his eye exam. It still couldn't get in. All right. But because you did, and the idea of being a shirker, that was like the cosmic Shonda, was that you shirked your responsibility. All right. In our day and age, people would regale each other with stories about how they got out of it. Okay, forgive me for being slightly political on this. But, you know, there was a time that instead of people bragging about how many times they went bankrupt so that they could keep their billions, there was a time that people would be ashamed to talk about it. And certainly wouldn't, you know, use it as part of their presidential platform. Not wanting to push the point. I'm not speaking about anybody in particular. Okay. You know, that the we live at a time. I mean, the classic story about this actually, Arne Eisen, who's the you know, the chancellor at the seminary now, and Stephen Cohen, who are, you know, the great sort of sociologist demographer of American Jewish life. That the two of them, they wrote a book together on American Jewish identity, and they interviewed this one woman named Sheila. And they asked her, like, what her Jewish practices were like. And she said, well, you know, I do this, this, and this, but I ignore that, that, and that. You know, I don't think you really call it Judaism. I think you have to call it Sheilaism. Sheilaism. Her name was Sheila. So it was Sheilaism. Okay. It's like Judaism, right. But, yeah, who is Judy anyway, right? Judaism. No, but this is Sheilaism. All right? So it's not like our religion, it's not our shared religion, it's her religion defined by, you know, what she took of the smorgasbord of Jewish life. That's not a horrible thing, but if you think that's going to survive for a couple of thousand years, you got another thing coming, all right? But if you said to her, excuse me, it wasn't really up to you to decide whether or not your, you know, Shabbos was supposed to be in the list. You know, we don't decide on that list. The list is given to us. You know, yeah, we might decide what of our, you know, which parts we're going to follow and which parts we're not, or, you know, what we're going to obey and what we're not going to obey. But it's not up to us to decide, this is the list of what God wants. No, we already know what the list is of what God wants. But in the modern age, we arrogate to ourselves not just, you know, the decision about whether I'm going to follow the mitzvot or not, because that's, everybody's always had that option. But we're arrogating to ourselves whether we should include these things on the list or not. So it's no longer even in the picture to decide whether I'm going to, you know, follow this mitzvah or not. I'm simply going to write it off and say it's not a mitzvah. Right? This is an utterly unique situation that you don't have historically. You know, people leaving the commandments behind, going to a different religion, that you have. People saying, no, I'm going to rewrite it, that you don't have. Okay, so going back to page 71. Another creative interpretation of the phrase kingdom of priests is brought by Reb Levi Yitzchak, Levi Yitzchak of Berditchev, this fabulous Hasidic rabbi who was always sort of fighting for the defense of the Jewish people. I'll tell you a cute story about him in a second. First, Reb Levi quotes the old idea that there are three crowns to the people of Israel. All right, this comes from the Pirkei Avot: Torah, priesthood, and royalty. All right, these are the three sort of status symbols or status areas. You know, how do you establish yourself in you know, what status in America is? You know, how wealthy you are. You know, what kind of car you drive, and you know, what kind of house you live in, or something like that. For us, it was Torah, Kuna, and Malchut. Okay, the Torah, the people who knew Torah, that was one form of status. The Kuna, people who were in part of the priestly aristocracy, and then, of course, royalty. Now, the only one of these that is hereditary is that of Kuna, of priesthood, which isn't entirely true because royalty can also be hereditary. But priesthood is definitely hereditary. You can't become a priest unless you are born a priest. But Reb Levi claims that along with the hereditary nature of the priesthood comes the ability to pass on the holiness of the kahuna. Right, the Lord's portion is God's people, Jacob God's own inheritance. God chose Israel because they can pass their holiness from one generation to the next. Now, when you look at it that way, it makes me, this one keeps me awake at night. This one keeps me awake at night. It's one thing to say that I should live a certain kind of life. I'm good with that. I mean, I'm good with trying. I'm not so good at succeeding, but I'm good with trying. I'll be glad to try. But the idea that I have to pass a sense of kedusha, a sense of holiness, onto the next generation, you know, that I got to somehow pry them away from the computer long enough to be able to pass that on to them, good luck. That's really, really hard. And I would say, you know, one of the perennial problems people have, like with children intermarrying, for example. You know, where did I go wrong, Rabbi? We were members of synagogue. I sent the kids to Hebrew school. They had a bar mitzvah. I don't understand. And what I'm about to say now is not meant at all to be judgmental. I'm simply making an observation, okay? That it's one thing to say, I want to introduce a child to Jewish society. Synagogue, Kedima, USY, Jewish holidays. But that's not going to be enough. It just isn't. You have to also introduce the children to a sense of kedusha, to a sense of holiness. And that's a really tough number. That's hard to do. That's hard to do. And I think that when I look broadly at American Jewish life, and particularly, well, I would say all aspects of, even the ultra-Orthodox aspects of Jewish life, passing on a sense of kedusha, holiness, is incredibly difficult and incredibly poorly developed in our society. I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, whack their hands with the ruler until they learn how to say the Aleph Bet. It's one thing to say, you know, make sure they know how to daven, you know, that they can do the whole Amida in a minute and a half. Yeah, we could do that. Okay. But to teach them holiness, that transcendent sense that what you're doing all of this stuff for is not just because you're not supposed to write on Shabbos, but because they're supposed to be creating this holy, this sacred atmosphere. It's really, really tough. We have not developed it well at all. And certainly rabbis are as guilty of this, probably more guilty than anybody else, because for all of our sermons about saving Soviet Jewry and fighting anti-Semitism, all of which is good stuff, nurturing that sense of holiness, that's something that we have not done well. Not done well at all. Okay? Yeah, Jay?
Well, of course, the difference here is that you have an open society, you have the ability or the opportunity to spread out, whereas in the shtetl, you were much more compact and everyone did it, so this was part of you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but in Fiddler on the Roof, even though in spite of all that, she still married a non-Jew.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely.
So
and
you saw it there, too.
You know, I have this wonderful book at home entitled The Way We Never Were.
Yeah.
All right. And it basically talks about nostalgia. And this is not about Jews. It's about the image of the perfect family in America. Right, that will combine, you know, Father Knows Best with Donna Reed and come up with this entirely unrealistic picture that has nothing to do with reality at all. Well, that's what we do about the shtetl, where everybody was so religious. Really? Is that why half of the Jews became members of the Bund? Because they were also religious? Oh, and Jews always kept their faith. Oh, really? Is that why most of the Jews of Spain converted to Christianity? You know, wait, what? You know, this fantasy land. Oh, everybody was so frum. Trust me, it ain't so. It never was so. And that's why even now, I've mentioned this statistic before, that in Israel, 40% of the Kippah Segugah people, 40% of the knit yarmulke, sort of modern Orthodox guys, right, become secular after they get out of the army. 40%. Now, these are guys that grew up, you know, their Hebrew is perfect. They can handle any kind of Jewish sacred text perfectly. They know all there is to know about, you know, they've been observing the holidays the whole time. They can keep kosher by walking into any supermarket, blah, 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 blah. Their Jewish life is all there, out available. It's reinforced, the whole thing. And almost half of them become secular. Something obviously isn't getting passed on. You know, so that for all they know about the rules about how they're supposed to do something, the kedusha that you couldn't walk away from, that's not getting passed on. So I'm going to shift topics now, and we're going to talk about that kedusha, that goy kadosh, that holy nation. So on page 71, all right, let's quickly get past the word goy, because in modern Yiddish parlance and even in rabbinic parlance, goy becomes synonymous with non-Jewish person. But biblically, goy simply means nation, and it's not in any way a derogatory word.
Goy kadosh.
Goy kadosh. Right. Well, that's exactly what we're talking about. We should become a holy nation. Okay. So, goy kadosh does not mean the Pope. Right. All right. Goy kadosh biblically means us, right? So, okay. The Midrash, yeah, that was pretty cute. The Midrash says this implies that Israel will be a united nation as one body and one soul. And here, too, this is, you know, if I can give a little plug for the conservative movement here a little bit, this idea, this bizarre idea that people will be on the extremes of Jewish life and declare themselves to be the only real Jews is a very problematic and counterproductive modern phenomenon. You know, all these guys who are, quote, Torah true Jews, you know, it's just nonsense. It does remind me of the story. Did I tell you the story about the reporter finds out that these two people living on an island in Norway who consider themselves to be the only real Christians in the world? Did I tell you the story? So this is a nice human interest story. So he goes up there and he visits them. They find this nice little Norwegian house on this little Norwegian island, and they invite him in. And he says, you know, will you explain to me, like, you know, how you're thinking about this? And I said, yeah, sure. You know, it all started, you had, like, the Pope, and you had, you know, Roman Catholicism, and you had Orthodox Christianity. And, you know, Orthodox Christianity just got it wrong. They distorted the tradition. So then you had, you know, just the Roman Catholic Church. And then you had the Roman Catholic Church and the Protestants. And, you know, it was the Roman Catholic Church that at that point had, like, sort of gotten it wrong. So you had the Protestants. Now, among the Protestants, you had the Calvinists and you had the Lutherans. And Calvin, he didn't really understand, so it was just really the Lutherans. And then you had, like the Swedish Evangelical Church and the Danish Evangelical Church and the Norwegian Evangelical Church. And, you know, the Swedes, the Danes, they didn't get it right. It was only the Norwegians. But, you know, so the Norwegian Evangelical Church, you know, Norwegian Lutheran Evangelical Church, you know, they've strayed from the true doctrine. So, you know, we had to leave that church, and so we're the only ones that are still doing it the way it was meant to be done. So the reporter thought this was really interesting. He writes it all down, had a very nice visit, thanked him very much, and then, you know, sort of walked out, you know, walked out. The man of the house, you know, walked into the door, and as they got to the door, he opened the door and said, it was nice meeting you, and the guy leans out and says, I'm not so sure about her. So, you know, it keeps on getting down to this, you know, the smaller and smaller thing. That's not what we're supposed to be doing. One body and one soul. We are supposed to be united. And this is, we actually institutionalize this line in Mincha on Shabbos when we do the Amida. All right? Adonai Echad, Ushma Echad, Umi Kam Chai Yisrael Goy Echad Ba'aretz. And who is like your people? One nation in the earth. You know, God is one. We're supposed to be one also. Okay? Further implied in this is that whenever one Israelite sins, all are punished. A shanda for the goyim, right? And when one Israelite is hurt, all feel the pain. This is unlike other nations whose members sometimes rejoice in the pain of their neighbors. Okay? We theoretically don't do that, at least aren't supposed to do that. So, there's just a cute aside. I heard some Muslims who were speaking about San Bernardino, about the massacre, and one of them made the comment, you know, when I first heard about the massacre in San Bernardino, the first thought that went through my mind is, oh, please, I'll let it not be a Muslim, you know. I was just saying, I said, well, that does sound familiar, doesn't it? You know, well, you know, welcome to being an immigrant minority community.
Our imam was in at the speech last
night. Yeah, that's what I heard.
By
yeah, that's what I heard. That's great. He's been around.
Picture was in the Trenton paper.
Yeah, he's been around. That's, oh, God.
Rush Holt had invited him down for another speech.
Yeah, he had...
Did he leave the guy from the mosque here?
Yeah, Colin Chibley. Yeah, he's a very good guy, but, you know... I don't know when the real discussion is going to happen, you know, or if ever the real discussion is going to happen. I just don't know. That's, I'm very conflicted about it.
Yeah. Lebanon.
Yeah. So good luck, you know. But it is you know, as much as I firmly want to defend, you know, the civil rights of the Muslim community in America, and, you know, detest the, you know, the bigotry of, you know, the Trumps of the world, although I'm not speaking about anybody in particular. But I'm also rereading my 700-page book on jihad and the reality of it. And there's a discussion here that desperately needs to be had, and nobody's having it. It's very disquieting. Anyway, so when one Israelite sins, all are punished. We all know this. There's the classic joke, actually, that there was back in the Soviet Union of not blessed memory, somebody. There's a conversation between a Jewish communist and a non-Jewish communist, okay? The Jewish communist said, you know what the difference is between us? Right. Everybody holds me responsible for Karl Marx. Nobody holds you responsible for Stalin. Everybody holds me responsible for Marx. Nobody holds you responsible for Stalin. Okay, so that if there's a, you know, if a Jew does something wrong, all Jews are now responsible. If a non-Jew does something wrong, nobody looks at another non-Jew and says, see, this is your fault. Right. So there's this kind of collective thing there. The other side of it, though, is that when one Israelite is hurt, all feel the pain. I mean, the joke was, you know, if somebody sneezes in Argentina, if a Jew sneezes in Argentina, a Jew in Sweden says, Gesundheit. You know, that we are linked to each other in that way. And I'll just mention one example. When Israel was going through the red alerts with the Katyushas coming in, you know, there is an app that you can download that your cell phone will go off with the red alert every time there's a red alert in Israel. And if you think about it, that's an amazing thing. And I really sort of am kicking myself that I didn't do it, but it is something I do have to do. That, you know, when there are Jews on the other side of the world that are running to a bomb shelter, we should know that here. We should feel that here. You know, that's not just them, that's us too. The word holy means many things in the Bible. Rudolf Otto, as we pointed out above, describes the numinous, or the mysterium tremendum, the ineffable mystery of God. But when applied to the people of Israel, the term holy clearly has another connotation. Now, this is a place where I partially disagree with Ferenc Elkins. It is certainly true that, you know, Jews are people, God is God, and you know, whatever sort of mystical experience you have or overwhelming, you know, sense of spiritual holiness that you have before God is not exactly the, you know, what you're supposed to be feeling when you meet a Jew. Having said that, though, there is something, a feeling that we rarely talk about, of seeing Jews as being, I hesitate to even use the word, quasi-divine. Not individually, you know, it's not, you know, that any one of us is such great shakes. But in terms of what we do collectively, there are some times to really stand in religious awe of the Jewish community. And I'll give you two examples of that that immediately come to mind, and I'm sure there would be many more. I mentioned on Shabbos that there was when the earthquake happened in Nepal, all right, 40 hours after the earthquake, there was a full Israeli field hospital set up in Nepal. Okay, you know, it takes me 40 hours to get out of my driveway, all right, to get the kids to school, right? You know, here Israel schleps to the other side of the world in a 747 or whatever it is, with a full field hospital and some of the best doctors and nurses on the planet to the other side of the world to set up for this. That's one example. Another example was when I was at the AIPAC conference. This last one, they had a guy there. He was an American Marine, Hispanic, who had been paralyzed from the waist down as a result of a bomb in Afghanistan. And he somehow got hooked up with an Israeli company that invented an exoskeleton. All right, so it was like this metal frame that allowed him to walk. All right, and you know, he was there live, but they were showing pictures of him standing at the ceremony where he was released from the Marines. You know, so he's standing there in full uniform in this exoskeleton that the Israelis invented. Okay, trust me when I say, you know, there were 32,000 eyes in that room and none of them was dry. Oh, really?
He was involved. He's been in Israel a number of times.
I didn't know that. Oh.
With what the
company's doing. Ah, fascinating. Christopher Reeve.
Superman.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I did not know that. That interesting. Okay.
I'm aware of that but, company, the exoskeleton, I've read about it.
Yeah. I mean, you look at that and you just, you know, the third example, remember when Ronald Reagan was going to Bitburg? You know, there's cemetery where Nazis were buried. You know, SS people were buried. And Elie Wiesel comes to the White House and says, "Mr. President, their place is not your place." Now, you're talking about prophetic power there. You know, who else goes and talks to the President of the United States like that? Right? You know, except some congressman from South Carolina, but you know, who else would dare? And not only that they would dare, but they were invited when everybody knew this is what was going to happen. They were invited because of their prophetic voice. They were invited to come in and do this. Yeah, stand in awe. Stand in awe. I'll mention one other example, really moving experience. I remember when I was studying in Israel on Yom Yerushalayim, the anniversary of the reunification of Jerusalem, we took a tour, and it was a tour along what was called the Burma Road, which was this back way of getting into Jerusalem that bypassed the Arab villages and broke the siege where the Arabs had been, you know, besieging Jerusalem and preventing food and water from coming in. And you follow the Burma Road, and you eventually come out in the middle of nowhere. You come out to this monument, this obelisk. It's not really big. It's maybe 10 feet tall. And on it are the names of people that died in the process of building the Burma Road. And all it says is they blazed a path to Jerusalem. And I remember standing there next to Elliot Schoenberg, Rabbi Elliot Schoenberg, who's been, you know, for the past, I don't know, 30 years, he's been the head of the Rabbinical Assembly Placement Committee, you know, making, you know, shidduchs between rabbis and congregations. That's what he's been doing for the past 30 years. We were studying together. All right? We lived across the hall from each other at the seminary. And I remember him looking at that and saying to me, just remember, no matter what you do in your lifetime, you will never do something as important as what these people did. And he had forgotten that he said that, but I never forgot it. And it was, there's certain things that you do stand in awe of. You know, I'm not saying Jews are gods, you know, but Jews do some pretty godly stuff. You know, and if we're going to recognize the ungodly stuff that some of our leaders do, then we should at least recognize the godly stuff too. So, the term of the holy people is used in many passages throughout the Torah and the rest of the Tanakh. These passages uniformly point to the connection between Israel's carrying out the terms of the covenant, that is, imitating God and obeying God's laws. Such is the path to holiness. You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. For I am the Lord your God. You shall sanctify yourselves and be holy, for I am holy, etc., etc., etc. It's repeated over and over again. Okay? And again, I say, if you try and have a Jewish identity that is bereft of God, you are perverting the Jewish tradition. Right? It is simply not who we are supposed to be. The covenant is two-sided. Israel's part is to emulate God and obey God's mitzvot. God's part is to watch over and protect God's treasured, chosen people. Now, another part of the translation of holy is also to be separate from, distinct from. Right? Perushim is the way it's translated in Aramaic. And this is the origin of the word Pharisee. All right? If you just line up the letters, Pharisee, Perushim. All right, that's where it comes from. that the Pharisees were the separationists, and in what sense? They were the separationists in that they attempted to apply in their home, in their outside the temple reality, in their secular reality, so to speak, the laws of purity and impurity that applied in the temple. In other words, you could theoretically walk around in a state of physical impurity all you wanted, and then when you went to the temple, you would then, go to the mikveh and do whatever rituals you needed to do so that you'd then be able to go into the temple. The Pharisees felt that one should, on a consistent basis, seek ritual purity. So that, the vessels that you ate from in your house and the objects in your home and your physical body should either remain in a state of purity, or else if it became impure, should be purified so that it would be in a state of purity. Right? And as a result, they had to separate themselves from others who were not following the same rigorous laws. But the whole point here was that they were trying to apply the laws of the kohuna, the laws of the status of Kohen, they were trying to apply those into their daily practice. Right. In this sense, the Israelites are to be separate from the nations of the world in their moral behavior, their emphasis on ethical monotheism, and their commitment to the sacred covenant with God. And that's why it's so important for us as Jews to be able to articulate that on most political issues, we have a stance that is different from, say, the American poles of a discussion. Take abortion as one example. Okay? The Jewish position is neither the right to life nor the right to choice. Right? It's a much more complicated intermediate position than either of those. Okay? We do not believe that life begins at conception. Right? But on the question optional abortion. Optional is not the right word, but where you're choosing an abortion, not because it's like medically mandated, but because you want to, where you're basically using it as a form of birth control. All right. The traditional Jewish response is asur aval patur. It is forbidden to do it, but it's not to be punished. Okay. So in other words, it is yes, woman controls her own body. All right, and nobody can stop her from doing this, and nobody punishes her for doing it, but it's forbidden to do. All right. Now, that's a position that matches nobody in American society. All right. It's just not the way we're supposed to be acting. Right. And for us, it would be a very healthy thing for everybody involved if we were able to articulate our own view about these kinds of things. Right? And the same would be true about everything, death penalty, taxes, business ethics, and on and on and on. We have our own take that's different from everybody else's. Rav Avadya Svarno has still a different meaning for holy, emphasizing that the Israelites would not perish but last forever. So holiness is synonymous with eternal. And that carries with it its own implications, but I'm not going to go there right now. Dat Mikra brings another interesting aspect of being a holy nation, that it provides divine protection. In support of this, it brings the verse from Jeremiah 2:3, Israel was holy to the Lord, the first fruits of God's harvest. All who ate of it were held guilty, disaster befell them. That God is going to protect his holy people. And finally, the Midrash HaGadol, 13th century, points out that the word kadosh, holy, applies to many entities in the Bible, the people of Israel, to the Shabbat, and so forth, but they do not imply that the holiness of God is the same caliber. God's holiness is a separate, higher category. There is no holy one like the Lord, and kadosh kadonai, and kadosh kadonai, from El Adon. So, we have this kind of paradoxical thing where God says, you shall be holy because I, the Lord your God, am holy. But don't imagine to yourself, don't have such an ego inflation as to imagine that you're such a big deal. Right? And frankly, if I could revert now to a political topic that I brought up shortly, in reading the book about jihad, and a sort of common theme among the classical Muslim commentators on the Quran is this idea that even certainly the pagans, but even the people of the book, have sort of willfully misinterpreted the divine message. And it is, the responsibility of the Muslim community to force their submission and humiliation, which is our submission and humiliation, to sort of restore divine order. And I'm looking at this, and I'm reading this, and I'm saying, I'm trying to put myself into their shoes. And I'm saying to myself, the slippery slope on this one to become a real monster. I mean, it's not a slippery slope, it's a slippery cliff. It's ISIS.
They can't decide between themselves, which is whether you're Shiite or Sunni, which is right. As you're, a splinter group, you're out of it totally.
Yeah, yeah.
How can they even begin to say another religion is...
The level of violence that is implicit in this, in that judgmentalism, as you say, Rachel, they're fighting amongst themselves. You have Shia and Sunni. You've got various splinter groups. All of that, it's like an open invitation to ego inflation. I'm right, you're wrong. Rabbi Seymour Siegel, one of my teachers at the seminary, he said, a fanatic is not somebody who's prepared to die for their principles. A fanatic is somebody who's prepared to make you die for their principles. All right. And this is just like an open invitation to that ego inflation. And by contrast, if you think about the Aleinu prayer, it's even worth looking at. It's a good point. So if you turn to, page 160. So if you look at the Aleinu prayer, and you just look at the phraseology of it. Now, in contrast to how what I'm reading in these Quranic commentaries about how we are supposed to make sure that these infidels are humiliated and so forth. Look at the language in Aleinu. We rise to our duty to praise the Lord of all. He made our lot unlike that of other people, assigning us a unique destiny. So clearly that chosenness issue is there. We bend the knee and bow, acknowledge the King of Kings. He is our God, there is no other. He alone is our King. And then look at the bottom paragraph. And so we hope in you, Lord our God, soon to see your splendor, sweeping idolatry away so that false gods will be utterly destroyed, perfecting earth by your kingship so that all mankind will invoke your name, bringing all the earth's wicked back to you, repentant. Then all who live will know that to you every knee must bend, every tongue pledge loyalty. To you, Lord, may all bow and worship. May they give honor to your glory. May everyone accept the rule of your kingship. Reign over all soon and for all time. Sovereignty is yours in glory, now and forever. Thus it is written in your Torah, the Lord reigns forever and ever. Such is the assurance of your prophet. The Lord shall be acknowledged King of all the earth. On that day the Lord shall be one and his name one. You could read this entire passage and not know you were talking about Jews. We don't figure in this at all. Except, obliquely in the sense that we're supposed to be living these model lives. But there's nothing in here about how, everybody's going to submit to us, and that would be the same as submitting to you. All right. We're not going to kill. There's not going to be any convert or die coming out of this. All right. Yeah, we hope that the whole world recognizes God. Yeah, we do. That's right. Okay, let's go eat. there's a world of difference. And when you read the description about how the infidel is supposed to be brought to the lowest place of town in town. He's supposed to be kneeling, and the Muslim official who's supposed to accept his yearly tax, his jizya, is supposed to be standing above him, and he's supposed to pay, keep the infidel supposed to keep their head down and drop the money into the arm of the official, and the official's supposed to slap him across the face, so that he'll feel the full humiliation. I mean, you're talking about a sadistic ritual, and this was ubiquitous in the Muslim world.
All right. This is sprinkled throughout the Quran.
Yeah.
Well, we've got some pretty weird ones also. I mean, women in adultery and stuff like that. How are you supposed to tell that? I mean, that's like a little weird too.
Well, okay, yes, you do. The point was made that, we've got some pretty weird laws in the Torah too. And that's certainly true. However, if you look at sort of the history of Jewish jurisprudence, what you see are conscientious attempts to modify, mollify, reinterpret, interpret away almost all of these passages. That when you look at, the Ben Sorero Moreh, the rebellious son, when you look at the adult, the woman is suspected of adultery, virtually anything having to do with women, there's been a conscious intent to mitigate what we would obviously perceive as negative. We evolved, but in this regard, they have not. I do not know, and I would love to see, and that's part of that conversation that we have not had. I would love to see that widely respected Muslim authority, the equivalent of our Maimonides or the equivalent of our Yosef Karo, who writes that all of these laws about jihad no longer apply. I would love to see where that is. Because to the best of my knowledge, I've never heard of any place like that, and I'm hardly an expert in this area, so they could well be out there. I would love to see somebody talk about them, because right now I don't see them. All I see, when you combine it with, kill the men and take the women and enslave the children, and it's all for their good. It's terrifying. It is cruel and sadistic, and it concerns me greatly. And it concerns me greatly we're not having this conversation. Okay, but by contrast, the way we manifest our holiness as the Aleinu prayer, right? It's not at all about us. The most commonly repeated word. What's the most commonly repeated word? Aleinu. Is you. We hope in you, Lord our God. You see your splendor, perfecting the earth by your kingship, so that mankind will invoke your name, bring the earth's wicked back to you, repentant. Not me, not us, you. All right. So God's holiness is, clearly a different thing. Okay, a different level. Okay. Now, just one last thing, and then we'll conclude and have ourselves some nosh. If you look on page 73, the idea of chosenness was never meant to be elitist. All right. It is given there that it is more a sense of obligation than privilege in the biblical message. The most powerful reminder of that idea is found in the third chapter of Amos, where the prophet reminds the people that they were chosen for extra punishment, that is, held to higher standards, rather than any special reward. So Amos says, "You alone have I recognized of all the families of the earth. That is why I will punish you for all your iniquities." If we were just some schlub somewhere, then okay, God wouldn't have any expectations of us. But we're supposed to know better. And with that comes a great deal of responsibility. Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch draws the explicit implication of being a holy nation. I just love this. A nation which does not exist for its own fame, its own greatness, its own glory, but the foundation and glorification of the reign of God on earth. A nation which is not to seek its greatness in power and might, but in the absolute rule of the divine law. And you know, as a barometer of how, you know, as Ed Koch would say, you know, how we doing, right? How much do we, or how well do we match up to Hirsch's description of what our mission is? In certain ways, we do. In certain very impressive ways, we do. In many, many ways, we do not. So, there's work to be done. All right. Have a great night, everybody. Let's go and get ourselves a nosh.